Solar winds blow at about 2 million miles an hour. When they reach our planet, 93 million miles away, in about 2 days, they help to create one of the most remarkable Arctic entertainments we can imagine. I'm Susan McGinnis, this is Conversations, and on this edition, the Northern Lights. Please welcome our guest, Dr. Neil Davis. Neil, thanks for joining us.
Pleased to be here.
I can't imagine any of us looking up into the sky when the aurora is out and not being touched and moved by it. What I want to do before we talk about what really happens up there is to think back to our ancient ancestors around the pole and their time and what they believed about the Northern Lights before they knew about solar winds or electrons or magnetic fields. What did they think was happening up there?
Well, I suspect that the legends that exist today, Eskimo legends and Indian legends, which treat the Northern Lights as spirits, of course, everything was spiritual. People that lived farther south, where the auroras were less prevalent, occurring only rarely, they really probably didn't know 1,000 years ago, had no idea of the first scientific views, I believe, were that the aurora was some sort of an extension of the sun's atmosphere. And then finally, in 1857, there was a huge solar flare that was seen visually, and several days later, then a huge aurora occurred. So that was the first real identification that it was based on something happening on the sun, and that several days usually were going by. And at least that identification was made. And then, but it wasn't until 1958 that when satellites went up that really began to realize there was a solar wind. So it's a fairly new concept.
As we've learned more about the sun, then we learn about the aurora? Has it happened in that way, or are we learning about the aurora to learn about the sun?
Well, both. The things we see on the sun, some of the curious structures in flares, striated shapes that we see in photographs occur in the aurora too, and so there's quite a potential to learn about the sun from the aurora, and actually even to learn about the sun's history. It's been suggested that there are enough records going back several thousand years to of auroral displays that if they're really dug out of the monasteries in Europe and out of the places they're kept in the Orient, that may be able to learn more about the history of the sun during that period just from the aurora.
Oh, this is remarkable. The people taking careful notes about what they saw 1,000 years ago could teach us today about the history of the sun.
Yeah, the first records go back about 4,000 years.
I said that solar winds blow at about 2 million miles an hour. They blow in all directions, right? It's just the heat of the sun that creates that?
Well, basically, the sun is continuously giving off material. It's mainly electrons and protons, very tiny particles, and these just flow out in all directions away from the sun. But they do go out directionally. If there's a sunspot in the center of the sun, as we see it from the Earth, then and material comes out of that sunspot or the region around it, and this is typically what happens. We get enhanced flows from those active regions. That blows then right out and hits the Earth. But one off to the side on the limb of the sun would not.
I wonder how basic we need to get. It helped me a lot to know that electrons are extremely tiny. 2 billion atoms might fit in the period at the end of a paragraph, and electrons are parts thereof. Is that a good way to characterize?
Yeah, well, they certainly, they're electrons and protons and neutrons are the basic building blocks of matter, and a hydrogen atom is just an electron and a proton. An electron's negative charge and the proton's positive. So if you break down, if we heat up a solid, it turns to a liquid, and if we heat the liquid, it turns to a gas, and then if we heat the gas, it'll turn into what's called a plasma, where it's actually breaking apart the atoms, and then so we would see a large population of electrons and protons.
And in part, it's the breaking apart that sends those electrons blowing away from the sun.
There clearly is a pressure there, the continuous production of these from the sun's surface just causes them to go out. The word solar wind really is very apt. It is a wind, really. But we just have to think of it, I guess, as something that's coming out from that one point and in all directions.
The notion of a blast furnace also helps because we can feel that intensity of that heat. This is Dr. Neil Davis. Today we're talking about the Northern Lights. And let's get down to Earth because that's where we experience them. The electrons come streaming at us. And what brings them to us, into our atmosphere, so that we get to see what we see?
The material coming out in the solar wind, the electrons and protons, and there are equal numbers of them, as they approach the Earth, they run into the Earth's magnetic field. And these charged particles cannot traverse a magnetic field, so they're blown, or it's like water running in a stream up against a rock. The Earth's magnetosphere is the rock, and the particles flow around the sides, but some do enter, and they get into the magnetosphere, into the magnetic field. But even then, they still do not like to go across a magnetic field. They try to follow along the direction of the magnetic field. And the Earth's magnetic field is like that of a bar magnet, with the field lines coming into the polar regions. So the particles then are guided into the polar regions from wherever they come into the magnetosphere. So they're brought down almost vertically into the Earth's atmosphere in the north and the south.
Just compelled, the magnet draws them like so many filings around a magnetic bar.
The magnetic field does not really attract them in that sense. Okay. It merely guides them. And the particles have a great deal of velocity, but a lot of energy, so they're moving somewhere, but they're guided by the magnetic field. And actually, the magnetic field does not accept energy from them or give them energy, curiously enough. It's strictly a guiding.
Just bounces them a little farther forward towards us. Is it the combination of the electrons, the magnetic field, and the atmosphere that makes the lights, or are there northern lights higher up?
No. The aurora, or the northern lights, really is an emission of the atmosphere, and that emission is created by the particles coming in. The electrons and protons, it's primarily electrons actually that produce the aurora that we see. The energy is coming from the sun. It comes out in the solar wind, and then it's getting into the Earth's magnetic field, the so-called magnetosphere, streaming on down and depositing in the atmosphere. There's quite a bit of energy there. Actually, the amount of energy that comes in, only a tiny part of it creates the aurora that we see. There's a lot more energy coming. About 96% comes in and heats the high atmosphere.
What makes the light?
The light is actual emission of the gases in the atmosphere, nitrogen and oxygen primarily. It's just the same thing as in a neon tube, really. The the electrons are flowing through the neon or whatever other gas might be in such a tube and striking the atoms or molecules in the tube and giving energy to them, and they don't the atoms and molecules don't like to retain that energy, so they will eject it, and it will come out in the form of light, chunks of light.
If we think about, can we also think about static electricity, like two socks out of a dryer, or shuffling across a carpet and touching a doorknob? Is it that kind of a light as well?
Yes, the in a spark is what you're mentioning. We see the light is given off in the same way that from the it's the air in the spark gap that is giving off the light.
Collision.
Yes.
And little tiny explosion.
Yeah, basically, in a sense.
Okay. You know. Okay. The Northern Lights on this edition of Conversation. So the electrons come streaming down. They crash into atoms or molecules of oxygen or nitrogen.
Primarily those.
You mentioned a neon tube. Is it? It's the gas that makes the color inside the tube. So is it the gas that the electron strikes that makes the color in the atmosphere?
Yes, that's right. It's the gas that's in the tube there. And now in the fluorescent tube, it's a little different. The electrons are hitting the walls of the tube, and there's a material painted on there that will eject the light. It's very much the same as in a television camera is what's happening. On a television camera or on a monitor, there's a phosphor that is struck by the electrons, and the color then is created by the materials that are in that phosphor.
Can you say that a little more simply for me?
Okay.
I have a television. Electricity comes into it. And then what? How do I get the picture on the screen?
Well, the aurora is well described by the so-called television analogy. If we think of the Earth's atmosphere over our head as just a big television screen, then when we look up and see the aurora, it's the footprint of these streams of electrons that are coming down through the body of the tube. From the source, which is at the outer edge of the magnetosphere, when you think of it as going clear back out to the sun.
Mm-hmm.
And so the magnetic fields and electric fields inside a television tube or guide the particles to make a picture that we see. And of course, in the television tube, this is contrived by man. The same thing is going on in the magnetosphere that dictates where the aurora will appear.
I don't know how to ask this. Is the knowledge that created the television an accidental equal to what creates the aurora?
Let's see. I'm not sure I understand what you're asking now. You say the knowledge that created the television that allowed.
Is it an accident that the television is the same sort of process as the aurora?
No. Certainly is not an accident. The process. Are natural. Man's ability to understand how magnetic and electric fields work allowed them to design the television system. And it's the same physics as is occurring naturally in the aurora.
And it's just that we understood later how the aurora worked.
Right. Well, mm-hmm. it wasn't. Too much difference. Let's see, television started coming in the 50s. I guess we've had that knowledge, 40 or 50 years now on television. And really, it's about the same period of time that a fair understanding of the aurora has occurred. So a very similar time scale.
Let's take a look at what the aurora looks like to us in just a second. Our guest today is Dr. Neil Davis. We're talking about the aurora borealis. Aurora was the goddess of dawn. Borea was the god of the north wind. The names came together to create the aurora borealis. Dr. Neil Davis is our guest today. He is a long-term professor of the University of Alaska Fairbanks. He began his academic career at the University of Alaska Fairbanks as an undergraduate studying geophysics. He graduated in 1955 from the University of Alaska Fairbanks, went on for a Master's of Science degree at the California Institute of Technology in 1957, and then returned to the University of Alaska Fairbanks to pursue his PhD, which he took in 1961. He has, with a very brief hiatus, worked since that time and up until his retirement at the Geophysical Institute here at the university, and spent most of his time studying the aurora. Dr. Neil Davis, our guest today on Conversations. When I look, when I stand in Fairbanks and look straight up in the sky, sometimes the aurora that's above me is just a wandering wave. It's where I'm standing that affects what I see rather than the thing that exists above me. Isn't that right?
Yes, very very much. If we see aurora low on the horizon, we're really looking at the side of it. The aurora occurs primarily in sheets, near vertical sheets. Very thin sheets. Most auroral forms that we see, at least in the evening hours, are their bottoms are up about 50 miles above us, and from there they'll extend up another few tens of miles above that along the direction of the magnetic field, which is nearly vertical. And so these are vertical sheets, and they can be very long, sometimes thousands of miles long, extending from horizon to horizon and beyond. But then they're so thin, only about a football field length, 100 yards or 100 meters in thickness. So it's when you look at something like that, what you see depends very much on what direction you are looking from. If you look at a piece of paper from the top, we see a full sheet of paper. If we turn it on edge, then we just see a thin line. And that's the way it is with the aurora, too. So the aurora that we see out on the horizon may have all those waves and curious shapes in it, too, but you don't recognize that. But when it comes in over the top of us so that we can look up into the aurora, we see then the intricate structures and the swirling around. And one of the characteristics of aurora is that it's basically always moving. And so if it's active, you get the truly beautiful auroras, then they're usually overhead.
This always moving means also always changing, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think we miss a lot of aurora, and I want to ask you about that. When the aurora is first in the sky, it tends to be diffuse, not well formed like we may see it later. And that's what I think we miss. We think maybe that's a cloud?
In early evening, usually, unless there's an extreme an aurora going, in which case it may be overhead or even south of Fairbanks as it gets dark enough to see the aurora. But usually we'll see the aurora to the north of us, and it will often be weak. It tends to get brighter as the night goes along, not in a regular fashion, but those weak auroras, particularly if it's near twilight, and to remember that there can be quite a bit of light in the sky, even though the sun is down where we are. The sun is still shining on the high atmosphere, and so that will make it more difficult to see that aurora. But the aurora does it goes through a lot of cycling in intensity. And so you're right in that typically we tend to see the weaker ones in the evening, and it gets brighter later on. So the amazing thing is people are often not aware how often the aurora really occurs. Here at Fairbanks, on any night, any dark night that's clear enough, if a person will stay up all night, they will see aurora. There's never happens that there isn't aurora to be seen.
And that's simply because it's constantly coming from the sun. The sun is
right,
constantly...
Right. There's a continuous rain of particles, of electrons and protons coming into the polar regions. And it changes in intensity by radically by many, many factors. But it's always there. Satellites flying over that can detect the particles will always be able to measure the incoming particles. And when mm-hmm. photographs or images are made from high-flying satellites, they show the persistence of the aurora.
Can you describe some of the classic forms and why, if it's just electrons smashing against atoms, are there repeated patterns and forms? Why does that make sense?
The forms that we see in the evening, usually the most common one is called an arc. It's just a smooth, uniform, and it's just a ribbon in the sky there. If it starts, as it gets more active, it tends to become more convoluted, and then it's called a band. Basically, they're the same thing, the so-called discrete aurora. The shapes that we see, the locations where the aurora is, and the shapes that we see are determined strictly by the pattern of the particles coming in. These are sheets of electrons that are coming down the magnetic field, and there is a lot of interaction between the particles. The particles are charged particles, and they're moving. A moving charge creates a current, and a current will change the magnetic field. So it's characteristic of material in the plasma state, that is where there are high concentrations of charged particles, to be rapid moving and striated. That's one of the really interesting things about the aurora, is that striated character. And in fact, this is far from understood as to why this occurs. That's one of the big unknowns. Not too many years ago, here on the Fairbanks campus, there was a symposium on the auroral arc, and the whole symposium, several hundred people were attempting to just look at why does the auroral arc occur. Why isn't it just a big a glow across mm-hmm. the sky? Mm-hmm. So there's a real mystery there, and that's one of the fundamental mysteries of the aurora, is why is it arc-like?
Is this one of the reasons you got into the field, that this is so there and such a mystery at the same time?
Partly. I grew up on homestead not far from Fairbanks, and I saw aurora when I was young, really a lot of, and we didn't have electric lights, so we saw a lot of aurora at night. But really it was mostly accidental. When I was an undergraduate student, I was undergraduate and graduate, I did a lot of work for the director of the institute at that time, C.T. Elby, and his interest was in aurora, so he was having me do various things. I, at the time, did not, while I found the aurora fascinating, I thought that it was probably nothing of terrible importance, and my view was, I'll go on ahead and get a Ph.D. By studying the aurora, and then having acquired the knowledge and the degree, I can go out and do something useful.
Find my real work.
It never occurred to me that the aurora was of any consequence. However, I the time was when satellites first flew, and suddenly the work that I had been doing on the Aurora was of extreme interest to Earth scientists and people in space, what became called space science. And it turns out the Aurora is a terrific tool for studying the near-Earth environment and out to the sun. So it's become a very important thing, and I didn't understand that.
It was a lucky accident, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Dr. Neil Davis is our guest today on Conversations. We're talking about the Northern Lights. This accidental profession has created, at least this one book called The Aurora Watcher's Handbook by Neil Davis. It's published by the University of Alaska Press. It is very much in print, very much available at local bookstores. The thing you might find most, if you're a fledgling Aurora watcher or a fledgling thinker about the Aurora, find the most immediately valuable is that this book is written on several different levels. It's written for the person who just wants to go outside and look at the lights. It can help you learn how to watch, how to photograph, and how to think about the Northern Lights. And then it is written at several deeper levels, as he says, on cloudy nights or during the day, if you've got time to contemplate, you can read section 9 or section 11, which will tell you more. On this edition of Conversations, we're looking at the Northern Lights. This is Conversations on KUAC. I'm Susan McGinnis. We were talking a minute ago about the various shapes that the aurora take, and I want to not leave that for long. In the course of an evening, the aurora can change from a diffuse cloud to, as you said, an arc or a quiet ribbon, to what the Eskimos call dancing spirits with wild dances, and then fade away to diffuse again, and may repeat that pattern. Is that part of the unknown yet, or is that a factor of how the electrons come down into our atmosphere?
Both, actually. As you say, in the evening we typically see arcs. As time goes along, these will usually brighten and become more active. Usually sometime during the night, and perhaps several times, we end up with a spectacular surge of activity, and this is called the auroral breakup, or it is also now known as the auroral substorm. Dr. Akasufu at the Geophysical Institute was the one who really discovered what was going on there in the substorm. The substorm is a global event that affects the whole upper atmosphere, the whole magnetosphere, actually. And that process is still not understood. What really is going on in the substorm, this remains a mystery. It may be, one view is that the substorm is merely reflecting the rate at which energy is coming into the magnetosphere from the solar wind. And another view is that the substorm is some explosive happening within the magnetosphere that in this view, the energy is coming in, getting stored in the Earth's magnetic field, stretched in the field, and then something happens. The rubber band snaps or some event occurs where there's a sudden transfer or exchange of this energy from magnetic energy stored in the magnetic field back to kinetic energy, the energy of motion of the particles, and then huge flows of the electrons are driven down into the atmosphere, and we see than these very bright, extensive auroras. The breakup is the spectacular aurora, and it usually only lasts a few minutes. And then, as you said, later on, the aurora usually becomes much more diffuse and patchy. We lose the arc-like structures. But then another strange thing happens, getting a pulsating aurora, where it pulses on and off, these patches of light pulse on and off for several hours. And most people are never aware of that because it is quite weak. Usually when the breakup occurs, everybody goes back inside because it seems like the show is over. But in fact, there's a lot of fascinating things happen after that.
You should stick around. This is what I should ask you next. Are there ways that we should watch? I mean, most of us just zip up our coat and get out of the truck or go out where it's dark and stand there as long as we can.
Well, I think it really doesn't matter how much you know. It's such an enjoyable thing, and even if you know a huge amount about it, still those brilliant displays are pretty exciting. And I've seen a lot of them, but the hair stands up on the back of my neck still during a good display. I've lost my train of thought there on that.
Well, I think that's quite wonderful, actually, that you've studied this for 30 years and the hair still stands up on the back of your neck. It's great. What a pleasure to be in a field where you don't get bored.
Yeah, it's I think it helps a lot, actually. As I say, doesn't matter how much you know, but if you do understand that these forms that you're looking at are ribbon-like, they're standing vertically in the sky, and the particle streams that are coming in are following along the Earth's magnetic field, and one of the consequences of that is that the auroral rays that we see are aligned along the field, and those rays all point up vertically. And they appear to converge at a point called the magnetic zenith, and that's almost directly overhead here at Fairbanks, a little bit south of the true zenith. But that's where we see the really spectacular forms is around the zenith region, our zenith region. But it's interesting, for example, one of the things about the aurora, you never see two auroras cross.
Uh-huh.
They never do. There's something inherent. You wouldn't find it. They were not like streets crossing each other. If an aurora comes up against another, it will bend close by, perhaps, but they never cross.
And so are they affected by each other?
Yes, clearly. And they, there are repeating patterns there. And I think enjoys it more if you do understand a little bit of what is there, and those, particularly the fact that they are vertical, and you just wouldn't realize that, I suspect, by and large.
No, I think it's quite wonderful to learn how high above the Earth they fly, and then how much higher than that they are, how tall they are. That was one of the things I learned that I've cherished. I'm looking forward to seeing my next satellites. Now that brings me to something. You said in your book that if someone tells you they saw great lights last night, that you ought to go out tonight and look. Why is that? Is that clusters over time?
Yes. Usually the best auroras occur during what are called magnetic storms, and these are periods of several days when a huge enhancement of material is coming out from the sun in the solar wind. And since they do, a storm will last for several days, then if there was a good aurora last night, the chances are it'll be a good one tonight. It probably won't be quite as good as last night, and then the one tomorrow night will not be quite as good either. It's usually the first night is the biggest display. But on the other hand, there have been times when for several days they've been extremely brilliant. During some of the greatest magnetic storms, as much as two-thirds of the Earth's sky is covered by aurora. coming down from both poles. And during a big one, you would see aurora in Baja California or in Cuba.
Remarkable. And that's just because it's so big. It, mm-hmm. Its effect goes farther down on the Earth's surface?
Yes.
There's a belief that when we see northern lights in Fairbanks, our opposites on the South Pole would see the same northern lights?
Exactly.
That is true.
Yes, that's the so-called conjugate aurora. This, it's been known for a long time that the auroras are roughly similar in the two hemispheres, but it wasn't until about 15 or 20 years ago, people at the Geophysical Institute and Los Alamos Scientific Laboratory teamed up, and we flew two airplanes, one out of Anchorage and one out of Christchurch, with cameras to photograph the auroras, and we programmed the airplanes to fly where they should fly to see the same aurora if it did occur, and in fact found exact copies. And so whenever you see an aurora here, there is basically an exact copy in the other hemisphere.
Why? Why
does that occur? The particles that are coming in to the magnetosphere have two choices, in a sense. They can go into the northern hemisphere or the southern, and in fact they probably do both. So the stream of particles then is going both places. And these particles can bounce back and forth as well in the magnetic field. So what that tells us, the fact that the auroras are exact the same in the two hemispheres, tells us that there is a good connection along the magnetic field, of course, between those two hemispheres. And it had recently, one can create essentially artificial auroras in a sense, either by using an electron gun and shoot into the other hemisphere to create aurora, and that has been done. And also things like barium clouds can be ejected from one hemisphere to the other.
Now, these two things have been part of the work of the Poker Flat Research Range, is that?
In part, I guess we would have identified that more as just the Geophysical Institute, and of course Poker Flat is part of the Geophysical Institute. Poker Flat is just a facility that is used for these types of studies.
When you send barium up, we hear about barium shots every now and again. What are we alerted to? What are you doing, and what can we expect to see, if anything?
Okay, there are two types. One is what's called a thermite release, in which just a large can of barium metal is ejected. And it, when exposed to sunlight, will glow and make a cloud. Actually, two clouds occur. There's a green cloud, which is quite spectacular, from the neutral barium atoms. And the sunlight then ionizes some of the atoms, and those ionized atoms emit a different color light, purple. And they are affected by the Earth's magnetic field. So they will develop a more complicated cloud that looks much like the aurora, except that it will be this reddish purple. Some of those releases that have been done from Poker Flat are so spectacular that they were seen all over Alaska, and they were released high. So there have not been such spectacular releases recently. In those early ones, there were about 50 kilograms, 100 pounds of barium was released. But you can still, with just a pound or two of barium, make a spectacular cloud that can be seen for a little while. And then the other technique is to put barium metal, use it as the liner in a shaped charge. And this is the same thing as the German bazooka, the tank killer, except they used copper in a armor-piercing shell. But if you put barium metal in, then you can eject when it's detonated, the barium goes so fast that it would actually escape Earth's gravity, and except that you shoot it up along the Earth's magnetic field, and it will trace out a magnetic field line. So that is being done more and more in recent years. So it's a technique for finding the exact shape of the magnetic field.
So this is not about aurora. This is about the magnetic field.
Right.
I see. Mm-hmm.
But the two are so intimately related that. In fact, we talk about aurora and geomagnetism as almost the same field.
Uh-huh. How do I ask you how much is known about the magnetic field? How sure are you that what is characterized is what is so?
Very sure. One happy thing about the magnetic field is that it's easy to describe mathematically. You can there are mathematical formulas that will describe it quite well, so that if you go out and measure the Earth's magnetic field at a few places, mm-hmm. then you can take those measurements, put them into some formulas, and calculate the magnetic field at other places. So it's quite simple in that regard. Let's see, and your question, though, basically, again, was... I think I drifted off a little bit of...
That's all right. You said that part of the work of Poker Flat is to research the magnetic field.
Oh,
and my curiosity was, how much do we know? How much don't we know about that?
The one way of verifying our knowledge about the magnetic field is to do artificial aurora experiments. Where we actually shoot beams of electrons along the magnetic field, say into the other hemisphere, and see the aurora in the other hemisphere. Mm-hmm. That traces out the field very exactly. Or the barium, the shaped charged barium releases, trace the field lines. So we know precisely, and those form then good tests of the calculations. So we can be quite sure that the calculations are good. One complication is that the Earth's magnetic field is continuously changing, and so that even if you make a map of the magnetic field today, after a few years you have to make another one because the changes have occurred, so it's not a constant, and it's complex in that. But I think it's very quite well understood. Not entirely. For example, we now know that the Earth's magnetic field has undergone repeated reversals in direction. And, just exactly how that happens is uncertain. It probably is due to the fact that the Earth's magnetic field is created by currents in the core of the Earth, in the molten core. And those motions of material of the that are creating the magnetic field irregular motions. And so perhaps the reversal occurs because the motions get to a certain point where it just flips the field over.
And you think it happens like that?
Well, it appears in the geologic record to have happened like that, but no one knows whether a reversal might occur in a few minutes or a million years, perhaps, but it's probably on a shorter time scale than a million years. We know that those reversals have occurred millions of years apart. But other than that, I think the magnetic field is one of the things we know the most about. Things we still don't know, though, are about plasma physics in general. What's happening on the sun, and it's a combination of electric fields and magnetic fields. And so, to say that there's good understanding of electromagnetic fields, that's not so. But the magnetic part is easier to understand than the electric.
Doors open.
Oh,
doors
yes,
to more questions, which
mm-hmm.
open. Yeah. Dr. Neil Davis is with us today on this edition of Conversations, and we're talking about the Northern Lights. In 1982, Dr. Davis retired from the University of Alaska Fairbanks Geophysical Institute, and he is now an emeritus professor of geophysics, has been so since 1982, also a senior research consultant at the Geophysical Institute. He was a professor of geophysics at UAF from 1965 to 1982. I mentioned earlier he took a very brief break, 3 years, to do research with NASA and the National Academy of Sciences at the Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland between 1962 and 1965?
Yes.
Right. He, during the 60s and 70s, from 1965 to 1977, was a senior administrator at the Geophysical Institute, had the positions of associate and deputy and acting director during that time. And from 1968 to 1971, the director of the Poker Flat Research Range. The existence of the Poker Flat Research Range is largely attributed to this man's efforts and energy. There are several books to Neil Davis's credit. The most recent came out in the fall of 1994 from local publishers McRoy and Blackburn. They are publishers of Esther, Alaska. This is something of a departure. It's called Caught in the Sluice, Tales from Alaska's Gold Camps, and is a collection of short stories about Alaska's gold camps. The first one I read in this collection, Dr. Davis says, has that fragment of truth in as much as it's the story of a man's life. A man existed, the end of his life is as described, and the parts in the middle came out of the imagination of the author. I'd recommend you to it. It's a remarkable little book. Caught in the Sluice, Tales from Alaska's Gold Camps. He is a biographer of the University of Alaska Fairbanks. The College Hill Chronicles emerged in 1993 from the University of Alaska Fairbanks Press. That's the story of how the University of Alaska came of age. It is a book of the University of Alaska Fairbanks Foundation, published by the UAF Press. Those are just two, along with the Aurora Watchers handbooks, of the diverse collection of writings that Dr. Davis has done. We have less than 15 minutes left, and I want to ask, if I can, nuts and bolts questions for Aurora Watchers. I asked you a bit ago, why it is that when my friend says the aurora was great last night, I should go out again tonight. That tells me about one kind of cycle. They say also that there is a cycle of 27 some days, that if there's a wonderful display, you should go out at least a portion of a month later. Why? What happens in that month?
The 27-day cycle comes about because the active regions on the sun that occur around sunspots are long-lasting. Sometimes these will last for 6 months to a year. So if a sunspot has occurred on the sun, a large one like this, in a location such that it sprays the Earth with a great flow of particles, and then we get a very large aurora. 27 days later, where that spot group will have rotated around the sun. The sun appears to rotate every 27 days on its own axis as we see it from the Earth. So that region can come around again, and perhaps several times. So that leads to the so-called 27-day recurrence tendency. So often that's one thing that does work very definitely. And then again, the magnetic storms that occur when these strike the Earth last 2 or 3 days. So we do have usually a 2 or 3 day period, and then 27 days after that. Then, in addition, there's the 11-year sunspot cycle too. So,
now what's that about?
Well, that is—it's not a very precise thing. It averages 11 years, but on periods ranging from about 7 to 15 years, sunspots migrate from the polar regions of the sun towards the equator. Now, this is not known why this occurs, but when the sunspots are at high latitude on the sun, they're not spraying towards the Earth, because the Earth is very near the Sun's equator. But as the cycle progresses, those sunspots move down towards the Sun's equator and then are more likely to spray material out towards the Earth. The 11-year cycle is something internal within the Sun, and that, as I say, is unknown as to what the cause of that is. But that has a very large effect. Here in the Fairbanks area or any place near the auroral zone, we tend to get auroras all the time, both sunspot minimum years and maximum, but usually the great storms that occur that will carry auroras down to lower latitude will usually occur during the maximum years of the cycle. So it's much more likely that people at low latitude will see aurora in that so-called 11-year cycle. We call it the 11-year cycle, but it's just the average.
Where are we in that rough average cycle now?
Well, since you never know until it's over, because of this variability in length, it's a little hard to judge. In principle, we've just passed a maximum, but who knows?
There were some pretty spectacular lights in 88, 89 mm-hmm. in that region.
Yeah.
So that's where we should kind of put our guidepost?
Well, I think it doesn't, operationally, to go out and see the aurora, you don't, 11 years is such a long cycle that you pay too much attention, but it is an effect. And for the person just going out to watch aurora, you just will notice perhaps you'll be hearing more about aurora during a maximum cycle.
What do you think about auroral sound? Is it?
I think so. Mm-hmm. Yes, this is a fascinating topic. There's little question in my mind that people receive a sensation of sound. Now, what it is another question. There are various possibilities. It's possible that the sensation of sound is created inside a person without there actually being a sound wave. And that's one of the things that makes this a fascinating topic, is that if we finally learn what auroral sound is and what causes it, we may have learned more about people than we have about the physical phenomena outside. However, I think the most likely explanation of auroral sound is that it is a discharge, an electrical discharge, created by electric fields in the high atmosphere that are transmitted down to the Earth, and that sound created in the vicinity of the person who hears it by discharge. Now, this is just one possibility. There are other interesting phenomena like that. There's a so-called anomalous meteor noise. If a meteor, a large meteor, goes directly overhead, sometimes people will hear sounds simultaneously. Now, that meteor is 40 or 50 miles high, and there's no way that a sound wave can travel from the meteor down to the ground and be simultaneous. And it's the mechanism for that may be the same as auroral sound. Interestingly enough, too, there's anomalous lightning noise, too, and I had not heard about this until recently. We're used to the idea that we see a lightning stroke and then we'll hear the thunder, and the time delay will tell you how far away the lightning stroke is. But sometimes, at the instant of the lightning stroke, people will hear a sharp noise, and that cannot be a sound that's coming from there. It has to be something that is transmitted by an electromagnetic wave, electric wave. And so
Why do you think none of these have been captured? We're so good at capturing things these days on camera or on tape for audio sound.
Well, it is amazing in a way. Of course, there's only ever been one serious attempt to instrumentally by scientific people to to look at this problem. This was done some years ago by Dr. Eugene Westcott at the Geophysical Institute. He got funding to do a 1 or 2 year study and put out a large ear, essentially a big microphone, and recorded. The results were ambiguous, didn't know whether it had things or not. And but since that time, sort of concluded that he had the ears pointed the wrong way, pointed up at the sky, and probably should have been pointed at the ground. It's difficult to get funding for something like this. Funding is so short always that funding agencies are not inclined to put money into something that might or might not exist. In a way, it's remarkable that the National Science Foundation at that time gave money to Westcott to do this. And the whole thing has been poo-pooed a lot and still is in the scientific community. The idea that it's really is all in one's head, that people see fast-moving aurora and think that whatever moves fast must make a noise, and therefore they hear noise. Mm-hmm. However, about 5 or 10% of the 300 reports that I've examined on auroral sound, people heard the aurora before seeing it. So those would negate that. A lot of the reports we get probably are, or some of them certainly are false, misidentification sound, but there's such a remarkable consistency in what people report and the behavior of the aurora during the sound that I'm firmly convinced that it's a real thing. Mm-hmm. What it is uncertain.
Dr. Davis, we're out of time. Thank you very much for this fascinating discussion of the aurora. So to our listeners, happy viewing and happy listening. You may be hearing what you think you hear. Dr. Neil Davis has been with us on this edition of Conversations. As I said earlier, I recommend each of the books we've talked about today, plus a couple of others. I'll give you just a bit more information. The Aurora Watcher's Handbook is a good book for the beginning watcher and for the watcher who wants to delve more into what the Northern Lights are all about. Caught in the Sluice, a book of short stories by this very talented man. It came out from McRoy and Blackburn in the fall of 1994. If you want to know how the university came of age, the book is the College Hill Chronicles from the University of Alaska Fairbanks Press. It came out in 1993. If you're interested in a thorough study of the energy resources of Alaska, Energy Alaska, there's a slash between those two words, Energy/Alaska, is a University of Alaska Fairbanks Press book that came out in 1984. That book resulted in an invitation by then Governor Steve Cooper to Neil Davis to chair the Alaska Governor's Energy Policy Task Force, which he did. He was also for 3 years the chair of the board of directors of the Alaska Power Authority, later renamed the Alaska Energy Authority. Neil Davis in 1994 received the Distinguished Alumnus Award from the University of Alaska Fairbanks, just one of many awards. This one acknowledged his role in the creation of Poker Flat Research Range, his innovative use of television for recording and analyzing the aurora, and his leadership as a professor, as a director for the Geophysical Institute, and as a director of the University of Alaska Press. I'm Susan McGinnis. This has been Conversations. Have a good time watching the Northern Lights, and I hope you join me again next week. Thank you very much.